This is Theatre Voice and my name is Alex Sears. Our guest for this session is the controversial playwright Howard Barker, a figure who has consistently divided critical opinion since his debut some 30 years ago. Barker has been astonishingly prolific, and most theatre buffs will have heard of, if not actually seen, plays such as Victory, The Castle, Scenes from an Execution, and The Europeans. To his fans, his work is an inspiration that questions the banalities of the British naturalistic tradition, offering instead a uniquely imaginative and often exhilarating theatrical experience. To his critics, his work appears as at best self-indulgent and at worst incomprehensible. But if his plays get bad reviews in Britain, that may be something to do with our national myopia. In Europe, Barker is admired as one of the major writers of Western theatre, and his plays sell more copies in foreign languages than they do in English. He is also revived more frequently abroad than in this country. And, as well as writing plays, Barker has also produced a much-admired collection of essays called Arguments for a Theatre, which outlines his ideas about what he calls a theatre of catastrophe. Since 1988, he has also enjoyed the unique distinction of having a special theatre company, the Wrestling School, which is devoted exclusively to staging his work. Their latest production, written and directed by Barker himself, is called Dead Hands and is currently touring nationwide. It visits London's Riverside Studios in the first 2 weeks of November. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Howard Barker. To start off, could you say a few words about the origins of your latest play, Dead Hands?
Well, it's always difficult for me to talk about this because they're always embedded in one's personal past as well. But I've always been interested in death, and I've just got a new book about death as a experience and a theatrical experience. And it's always seemed to me to contain a contradiction at the heart of it, which is its effect on the living, which is, of course, to destabilise them, as all bereavement does, but also to engender a kind of mild hysteria, which is to do with, I think, the spectacle of the cadaver, its lifelessness, its stillness. And the way in which that sort of generates an artificial but hectic energy in those who view it, and I know we think of funerals as very sedate occasions, but actually they are, internally at least, seems to be kind of riotous. And this is all contained within the formality of the funeral. And as far as the sexual goes, which is of course the kind of key instinct of life, that seems to be something that was actually generated by death. And this play is, to some extent at least, about that sudden eruption of sexual energy created by the death of a father and the spectacle of that death. That's one aspect of it. The second aspect, which is equally important, is the way in which the protagonist of this play, who's called F, symbolically I suppose, finds himself brought nearer in his instincts to the life of his own father, who exists in front of him as a body, and suffers that rather appalling sense that we all get at times in our lives, that we are not so very different from our parents, even though we may not have had much time for them.
Okay, the play is about a dead man and shows what happens to his two sons and to his mistress while he's lying there on stage in his coffin. It feels as if all three characters have become liberated in a way by the old man's death, and that they allow their sexual fantasies in a way to take flight. Is that right?
No, I don't think so. I think what happens is what appears to be, as in so many aspects of life, what appears to be a liberation develops into another form of bondage. You know, one could extend that to politics if one wanted it, but in this instance, it's what appears to be acts of free will suddenly appear to be totally conditioned, and that's, for me, the alarming, and I wouldn't call it tragic, but possibly despairing aspect of the piece, yeah.
As in common with your other plays, you do create this other world. It's not a recognisably naturalistic place, but obviously the emotions, the desires, the dark thoughts are recognisably human. How do you relate this invented space to the everyday world?
Well, theoretically, I don't think the theatre concerns itself with what you call the everyday world at all, in that whilst much theatre has been about reducing the barrier between the audience and the stage, I've always wanted to enhance it. So for me, every technique on the stage, including my technique as a writer personally, negate common experience in the normal sense of social realism, which I find a sordid habit, frankly. On the other hand, whilst all these situations are deeply speculative, they're not fantastical. And it's very important to make that distinction. They're not escapist, like theatre might have thought of itself being at various times. In fact, it's an intensification of experience that you're seeing on the stage, even though I fully expect no one in the audience to say, I recognise that, because for me the statement, I recognise that, is a futile and of no value to me as a writer at all. So these are real instinctive feelings, but the context is strange, and that's the distortion that I always aim for, both as a writer and as a director.
And clearly your exploration here of the erotic means that you are pushing out the boundaries of theatre. Could you talk a bit about how you do that with this particular piece?
Let's talk about levels of it. I mean, firstly, one has to talk about language. And after writing for 30 years now, I've refined a kind of form of discourse for the stage, which is, you know, very much my own, but is also quite natural to me, so it doesn't require a great deal of investment of struggle to produce that kind of language. It is now my discourse, as every writer who's experienced has his own discourse. But the characteristic, of course, is that it, as I say, is both non-naturalistic, but beyond that, it's also poetic. It permits metaphor, and what's more, which makes it interesting for actors who like that kind of work, it is it's almost got its own rhythm. So there's a musicality in the language. That's the first thing that separates it, I think, from normal theatre. The other thing is the way in which, when I direct, there's a very clear use of specific sound. The whole design concept is very particular, so as you suggested just now, it removes it from the real world, but at the same time, it's thoroughly of the world. It's speculative, it's not empirical. That's the key difference, I think. And everything in the production contributes to that effect.
Do you see it also as moral speculation?
Well, let me say at once, I'm not a moralist. And this is what separates me from, I think, nearly every other writer operating in the English theatre. I'm not interested in the theatre as a moral space. On the other hand, by giving rein to the instinctive and to the imaginative, one of course can't not but infringe various moral rules of, you know, the moral governing principles of society and the governing principles of theatre. It's got to be said, it's a very moral place at the moment and has been for some while. So you take a chance if you write this kind of work of running into an awful lot of critical flack for doing so. But if there's a moral debate there, it's one that's not set up by me. It's one that's a consequence of allowing a character to follow a thought to its conclusion. That's the important thing.
You mentioned critics. Do you think that they've misunderstood your work?
No, I think I probably understood it too well. I think that, you know, I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years and I've run into flack from the beginning. I've always been disliked by the establishment critics because the plays are not moral. I think they recognise that very early on. And you know, one has to talk about the whole spectrum of the English theatre to sort this out, really. It's very interesting. I mean, my case is the most interesting phenomenon, leaving aside my own feelings, my own career prospects and all the rest of it. The actual pretty well wholesale rejection of my work by the critical establishment is a meaningful and rather fascinating phenomenon. And you've got to put it, I think, in the whole context of what England as a place is. I mean, primarily it's a non-speculative culture. It's an empiricist, moralist, utilitarian culture in which everything has a use value. And one can pick on a critic like Michael Billington as that kind of critic par excellence, who always asks, what is the value of this text socially? In other words, does it have a function? In which case, it seems to me to wipe out the whole use of tragedy in the genre at all, because tragedy has no function, you know, and so, you know, that eliminates that. And the whole of the National Theatre, you know, what that stands for, its meaning as an institution, we can't ignore any of this.
I know that you see much of the current British New Writing scene as a bit banal, especially as regards its naturalism, and I think you've already mentioned its social realism. Could you say something about that and how your own project differs from it?
Yes, that's a big question, an extensive question. I mean, when I began writing in the very early 1970s, I produced a couple of plays that were those that were required by the Royal Court, inasmuch as that was a kind of key theatre at the time. They required that kind of play, and I could produce it. So I wrote a play about my own life, basically, as a South London youth. My nausea at that kind of writing, and my suspicion of what goes on at the Royal Court as a producing house and an ethical centre, developed quite early. And I was therefore drawn to a sort of theatre that did not rely on narrated experience or personal experience as being the kind of functional engine of it. And I wanted to write plays that were imaginative and took their whole authority from the imaginative. In many ways now, the whole Royal Court so-called revolution of the 50s and 60s has now become profoundly reactionary, I think, because it merely reiterates the idea of the street as the source of wisdom, the street as the source of authority and so on, which diminishes imagination, corrupts language, and worst of all, turns the actor into a member of his own audience, because you can see these kind of plays and the audience sits and it knows it can do what they're doing. In other words, the fracture between stage and public is diminished. Naturalistic speech is something anyone can do. Drama schools don't teach voice anymore. You hear this all over the place. The status of the actor is reduced, and so the whole experience becomes banal. There we are, in a nutshell, as well, that's what I think.
One of your recurrent themes, and you've already alluded to this, is reinventing dramatic tragedy. Could you say a bit about what tragedy was in the past and how your idea of it differs from that?
Well, Dead Hands is not a tragedy. I'll start off by saying that, because it's very, very hard to write a tragedy, and one does it. Well, I'm interested in it. I've done it a couple of times, perhaps, and I hope to do it again, but it's a very difficult form to achieve. It's essentially, tragedy is to me about death. It's to do with our relationship with death, and it brings death into the theatre immediately, either through murder or criminality. And the audience must be ready to receive death and to let it into their lives, at least for that amount of time, which doesn't happen with any other art form, really, I don't think. Certainly not with the thriller or the murder story. It is essentially about how one comes to death. And one therefore watches the protagonist in their struggle to arrive at the moment of death and to diminish, in a sense, to diminish the importance of death. So I think its social value and its psychological value is very huge. In doing that, of course, it cannot rehearse social values all the time. And as Aristotle, who's after all only a critic, let's get Aristotle into perspective, his way of turning tragedy into some sort of socially organized art form which makes everything better for society seems to me a complete misreading of Sophocles, anyway, to begin with. So when one writes tragedy, you're drawing an audience into something where their normal value systems are not applicable, or at least they become eroded very quickly if you're to go with it. That's what is exciting about the theatre. It is still, for me, hard as it is and corrupt as it is still the best place for moral speculation that's open to us. And the tragedy, let's be quite clear, is not a sad thing. Let's not use these words that Michael Billington uses, like pessimism and so on. Pessimism is a useless category in the theatre. Optimism is a useless category. So is utility. They're all useless things. The experience of tragedy is not sad. Chekhov writes sad plays. He doesn't write tragedies. Let's be quite clear. Some people think Chekhov writes tragedy. He doesn't. He writes sad plays. The tragedy is to do with someone overreaching. There's not a tragedy in someone like Uncle Vanya who doesn't do anything. That's not a tragedy. Tragedy is about doing things and essentially overreaching yourself. Macbeth for me is a wonderful example of that. And of course at that moment it's also replete with sex, one has to be clear about that. Macbeth is unthinkable without Lady Macbeth. So anyway, I'm quite going to answer your question, because you ask about my own aspect to it. Because I repudiate the whole idea of value, social value in tragedy, I'm interested in how the individual reconstructs him or herself from an experience of catastrophe. And those tragedies I have written involve that reconstruction of that individual, phase by phase, in clinging both to instinct but also to sexual passion as a means of defining themselves in a world which is catastrophically damaged, as they appear to be.